It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll kick off our monthly movie segment with a look at some of the best and worst book-to-film adaptations.
First, though, as we head into the long 4th of July weekend, you might be thinking about shooting off some fireworks at some point in your celebrations. There's lots of places to acquire said fireworks this week. Roadside stands, grocery stores, giant warehouses that seem to only exist right off the interstate. While each place might sell different products, the legality of firework purchases in Wisconsin is a little unclear.
And to make it a little more confusing, there's the enforcement of these laws, or lack of same. Joining us to make some sense out of fireworks in Wisconsin are WPR reporters Maureen McCollum and Glenn Moberg. Maureen's joining us from her office in La Crosse. Maureen, hi.
Hi, Rob.
And then we've got Glenn Moberg in Wausau. Hey, Glenn.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Veronica.
Hello.
Well, let's start with Maureen. Let's say I walk up to roadside stand, I buy a few sparklers for my kids. That's legal, no problem, right?
You will be just fine if you get sparklers.
Uh-huh.
The other things that you could buy for your kids, if you got, you know, those smoke bombs that you light and they let off colors for about 30 seconds, those are okay. Also, fountain fireworks are okay, and those are like the fireworks you'd place in the ground. Maybe it's a cone, maybe it's a tube, and it'll just shoot off different colors, it might whistle or something. Those are okay. What law enforcement kept telling me is that the rule of thumb is that if it flies or if it explodes, it's illegal.
It's illegal to possess.
To possess.
But we can
correct.
Buy those things all over the place.
But
how does that work?
That is sort of the million-dollar question. You can, and it's legal for different places to sell them, because I was even up at Target last weekend, and I could have bought some bottle rockets there, but I couldn't necessarily take them out of the store legally.
So, and bottle rockets, I mean, those you know, for this month, you hear them going off, the whistle pop sound all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time somebody's shooting those off, unless they're a licensed professional, I guess, they're technically breaking the law?
Correct. And that's the thing, is that the fireworks that fly, so like a bottle rocket, even if you got one of those fireworks that shoots off, you know, the paratrooper that ends up coming down, or like a giant mortar, unless you have a permit, you can't have them. But most people don't get permits, you know, I mean, just average people. You know, if it's like a community organization or a golf course or, you know, all these cities, they'll have different fireworks displays. They usually get permits. But if it's someone like you and me, who we see the roadside stand and are tempted to get a nice, beautiful firework, and we don't have a permit, then you're not supposed to get it, but we probably can.
Well, Glenn, let's bring you in now. How seriously are these laws enforced around the state?
Well, I think it depends, from my experience, on who the county sheriff is, how the sheriff interprets the law, and how seriously he wants to enforce the law as he interprets it. I'll give you an example. If you take Highway 51 up north, you'll go through Marathon County, and you won't see any big fireworks stands on the side of the highway. As soon as you cross into Lincoln County, there are three of them, back to back to back, a fireworks depot, a Victory Fireworks, and an Old Glory Fireworks, which literally straddles the Lincoln County, Marathon County line. If you go into any of those establishments, you can buy what are known as Class C fireworks. And these are the ones that, as Maureen said, they go up and they blow up. And a lot of them blow up with a vengeance. They sell what are known as 350-gram or 500-gram cakes, which refer to the amount of explosive material in the particular firework that you're buying. These cakes have aerial displays. One of the ones that I thought was really quite impressive is known as 19 crackling palms. All right, sounds
exotic,
mystical. Well, you light this thing off, and you run back, and it'll go, you know, patoo, 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 patoo. 19 aerial bombs going up in the air. Every one of them blows up and creates an effect of a palm tree leaves with crackling displays at the end of it, literally lighting up the entire sky. And these places are very, you know, very popular. And what they do is they make you sign a permit, allegedly a permit, which says that you're a member of a pyrotechnic safety organization, and you will only shoot these off under supervision.
And do most people sort of wink as they sign this?
Most people will load them up into shopping bags and put them in the station wagon and head up to the resort or head home. Now, of course, if you do shoot these off, if you live out in the middle of the country, you'll probably have less problems with it than if you live in a city environment where the neighbors are bound to, at least some of them are bound to complain. I mentioned three businesses. To give Old Glory Fireworks, which is one of the establishments there, they do open their grounds. They have rather spacious grounds on July 3rd, 4th, and 5th. And if you buy their fireworks, you can set them off on the grounds under the supervision of somebody who is trained and who has a license. But again, a lot of people don't do that.
And I wanted to ask both of you, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of discretion from county to county, maybe even city to city. Glenn, is there a move toward more enforcement of these existing laws or no?
Well, not in Lincoln County. We had a sheriff in Lincoln County. His name was Paul Prue several years ago, and he cracked down on the Class C fireworks stands. And I was working in television news at the time, and we used to send our crews out before the 4th of July, have them park their vehicles, walk around and look at what was being sold, and then they would call the sheriff and ask him if he knew that the Class C fireworks were being sold at these stands. The sheriff would swoop down, shut them down. We'd get wonderful video that we could show on the news that night. And, of course, we were there and the competitive TV station wasn't. Sheriff Prue was voted out of office. And it's hard to say exactly why, to pin it on one thing, but a lot of people think that one of those things was the fact that he was cracking down on the fireworks.
No kidding. And Maureen, are you seeing in the people you've talked to more of an effort to crack down on the sale or use of these things?
The law enforcement I talked with, different police and sheriff's departments, seem to have this very low on their priority list. You know, a lot of them said that they have better things to do than to actively pursue people shooting off fireworks. But if they did say anytime like a noise complaint comes in or, you know, if a neighbor has all of a sudden lots of firework debris in their yard because their next door neighbor's shooting them off, then they'll go and they'll check it out and they could get anything. There actually is a illegal firework possession ticket in most municipalities. But, you know, if it's a really big problem, someone could get a noise violation or a disorderly conduct ticket too.
That's all we have time for. But Maureen, are you taking in any big fireworks shows this week?
Yep. Here in La Crosse, we have the really nice big firework display down along the Mississippi River. I'll be going to that. And I may or may not have bought some of my own very legal fireworks that
Excellent.
I'll be shooting off.
Glenn, taking in any shows?
Well, I'm heading to Door County for the weekend, staying with a friend of mine who has a house there. And don't know where we're going, but I'm sure he knows where there's something worth seeing. So the answer is yes.
Glenn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
And thanks to you too, Maureen.
Thanks, Rob.
Maureen McCollum and Glenn Moberg are reporters here at WPR. They'll join us on Central Time from time to time.
Coming up next in our monthly movie segment, we'll be chatting about the book-to-film adaptations that'll be coming to theaters near you soon. And we'll also welcome your calls on the best and worst adaptations of all time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And here's a look at some of the latest news with WPR reporter Kristen Durst.
There are scenes of celebration in cities around Egypt on word that President Mohamed Morsi has been pushed out by the military. Fireworks have been exploding over crowds dancing and waving flags in Cairo's Tahrir Square. There have been shouts of God is great and long live Egypt. Hundreds of firefighters battling a blaze outside the mountain town of Yarnell, Arizona, have paused long enough to pay tribute to the 19 firefighters killed while fighting that blaze on Sunday. They came off the line today to salute a procession of five vehicles that had been left by the 19 elite hotshot crew members who died. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources wants more data from a company planning to open a huge iron mine in northwestern Wisconsin before approving bulk sampling activity. Gogebic Taconite wants to mine in the Pinoki Hills. The company filed paperwork with the DNR last month, outlining a plan to sample rock from five sites to assess the iron deposit's quality.
Thanks, Kristen. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Summer movies usually mean blockbuster Hollywood action, and this summer is no different. There's World War Z, there's Man of Steel, and White House Down, just to name a handful.
It's an exciting time if explosions and sirens are your thing, but if they're not, we have an idea for you. Autumn, when the serious Oscar contenders start coming out, isn't too far away, and a lot of them this year, it looks like, are going to be adaptations of books.
And so we thought, if action movies don't do it for you, while your kids or your friends are at World War Z, there are plenty of good books to read in preparation for the fall.
And we want to take your calls, too, on film adaptations of books this hour. Do you have any favorite book-to-movie transitions, or do you have one where the movie betrayed a book you loved? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or tell us your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And here with us to discuss the film adaptations coming out this fall is Rob Thomas, editor at 77 Square of the Capital Times and movie blogger at madisonmovie.org. Rob, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
So let's start with your favorite. What is your ultimate book to film adaptation?
Well, the one that I thought, well, they'll never be able to do this, was Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, which is just this massive book. Like, I remember as a kid, like, it would weigh my little arms down. It was just too much. But Peter Jackson made this beautiful three film, 10-hour, 12-hour with the extended cut that I thought captured what was great about the books. He put in stuff, he took on other things. It was just the perfect way to sort of stay true to the source material, but put your own stamp on it, which is what you want to do in a movie, right?
I enjoyed that a lot. And then there was The Hobbit. What did you think about that,
See,
Rob?
The Hobbit, I just don't think he's getting right. I think the problem is The Hobbit's like this little tiny children's novel or kids' adventure. I read it when I was like nine, I think, well before Lord of the Rings. And he's turning it into another 10-hour trilogy, and there's just not enough there. So every time in the book, somebody said, hey, remember when we fought those spiders? That's a 20-minute action sequence in the movie. So it's an example, I think, where he's trying to do the opposite and it's not working as well.
And Veronica, you said Lord of the Rings is one of your favorites.
Yeah,
of all
it's
time.
Totally one of my favorites of all time. Although I have to say, you know, like a lot of people, when you become so attached to a book, when you love it so dearly, I kind of alternately dread it coming out as a movie and look forward to it on the other hand, because it's in my head already. And that's why I think for me, Lord of the Rings was so successful, because it looked like what was in my head, only better.
Right. Sometimes I think the best movie adaptations are either from a book you haven't read or a bad book. Like the one I would point to is, like, I don't think anybody here would admit to reading Bridges of Madison County, but that was actually a pretty good movie with Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep in the mid-90s. I mean, sometimes it's like, if there's nothing there, if the book comes pre-ruined, they can't ruin it with the movie.
I admit to skimming that book, but I actually thought, I agree, I thought that was beautiful. I think I remember being sort of emotionally devastated at that movie because
right.
It was so beautiful.
And you didn't have to read the book.
No.
The best part.
So what do you think it takes to make a good book-to-movie adaptation?
Well, I think it's that balance between, faithfulness to the, I would say, the heart of the book, but also a willingness to realize, well, this isn't going to work in a movie. Obviously a movie's different than a book, and be willing to make those chances and say, well, I'm a fan of the book, but I want to make a movie for those fans. And that's a tricky thing to do. And there are some book lovers who will never forgive you if you took away that one part of chapter 17 that they love so much, like you, Veronica. And, but you know, that needs to be done. Like Argo was one of my favorite movies of last year, based on a nonfiction book. And I loved the ending, which was so exciting and thrilling. And I went to read the book in the bookstore, and that's like two pages of the book, that whole finale. And there was more drama going through Dane County Airport on a Monday morning than actually happened in real life. But hey, it's a movie, right? So you know, that's, you got to play some license with it.
They have license. It, wasn't that kind of the critique, you know, with Harry Potter, was that they were too faithful? They tried to excruciatingly recreate what was in Harry Potter, and it ended up somehow looking like a, I don't know, too direct a translation, that it just got flat.
Right. And I totally understand. I would be afraid of those Harry Potter fans, too, and just want to put in everybody. I haven't read the books, and I generally like the Harry Potter movies. There are parts where I was like, okay, I'm not going to understand this. But at heart, I thought it really worked. But
you didn't read Harry Potter?
I know, right? Too old.
And you call yourself a pop culture guy?
I know. I have a daughter to do that for me. I outsourced my Harry Potterdom. Yeah.
So looking ahead to some of the movies that are coming out in the fall, and that's part of what prompted our discussion here, one of them, a nonfiction adaptation, I believe, The Wolf of Wall Street with Leonardo DiCaprio playing yet another big shot. Is that one you're looking forward to?
Oh, absolutely. It's DiCaprio reteaming with Martin Scorsese. It's a story of, it's based on a memoir about this 90s high finance guy who, I mean, you look at everything that happened in 2008 with the meltdown. This is one of the guys who was living large and letting everybody else pick up the tab. And the trailer, which is out now, makes it look like a lot of fun. I mean, you know, he's completely amoral. He is, you know, bringing strippers and all kinds of people into the trading floor. And it's it looks like a really fun movie. And one I think that will work because it bring, you know, you read the book about all these horrible stories and Scorsese can actually bring them to life right in front of you.
I saw the trailer for that one this weekend and it looks over the top.
Exactly.
I mean, just like a sensory overload kind of movie.
Yeah, I think that one will be a lot of fun, especially with Scorsese directing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's one I'm looking forward to because it has Kate Winslet as a star in it. It's Labor Day, which is an adaptation of a Joyce Maynard novel. Do you know about that one?
I do, and it's directed by Jason Reitman, who has made two other really good book-to-film adaptations. He did Thank You for Smoking, the novel about the smoking lobbyist, and then he did Up in the Air, the Walter Kern novel about the corporate downsizer with George Clooney.
Yeah, that was a good one.
So I got a pretty good feeling he's going to do a good job with this one.
Are there other ones? There's a lot coming out. Maybe we'll bring some of those up. But are there other ones you're looking forward to as we get closer to the fall?
Well, the one I saw that looks really interesting is called The Monuments Men, which is not the easiest title to say.
Monuments Men.
Right.
Yeah, I hear you.
But it's maybe they'll fix that in post. But it's based on a true story about these curators and historians in World War II who were traveling around Europe trying to save all these priceless paintings and sculptures from the Nazis. And it's directed by George Clooney. It stars George Clooney, Bill Murray, Matt Damon. It's like a dream cast. And it just seems like just a great untold story of World War II. And I love World War II movies. I think that one's going to be really good.
Rob, are there any movies that you frankly don't want to see, or books, I should say, books that you don't want to see turned into movies because you just love them too much? You don't want anyone to touch them.
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I could have said, like, Sherlock Holmes books I loved from a kid, and it just seemed like they were wrong. And then the public television series, both the one in the 80s, the one now, did a good job with them. Not crazy about the Robert Downey Jr. one, necessarily, but, you know, I think anything's possible. I mean, if they can make a movie out of Cloud Atlas, anything's possible.
One that I love the book Dune, especially as a kid. And there have been, David Lynch took a stab at that. And there was a miniseries of it. So, and I realized reading the book again, half the dialogue is people thinking things to themselves. Like they're thinking the exposition for the book. And how the heck do you, like, translate that into a movie?
Right. Yeah. I just put a lot of big sandworms in it, I guess,
right,
and call it a day. Yeah. That's another beloved book where people, you know, I know a lot of fans didn't like it. But on the other hand, it brings people back to read the book and see how good it is. So maybe it's not, there's an upside.
You know, we've got some calls lining up. So let's take a quick one from Peggy in Cedarburg. Hi, Peggy. And Peggy, are you with us? She is not evidently with us. Should we try Don in Norwalk? Don, are you there?
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, you know, it's like kind of the classic thing that, like, the people say, oh, the movie's not as good as the book. But I thought, and this is showing my age a little, because I guess there's maybe some people don't know this movie, but I thought Dr. Zhivago, the movie, I thought it was better than the book. Because I read the book at one point, and it was really complicated. I mean, like, just, you know, a really tangle of plots and things. whereas the movie kind of streamlined it, but not too much, and put it in a, you know, a real believable historical context, you know.
Yeah, that's a classic movie. What about that
right.
one?
Right. I haven't seen that one, but I think that's a great example of what a movie can do, which is to sort of give you the heart of the book and then send you back to read the book and get all those tangled plots that they couldn't fit into the movie version. So, you know, that's an example where in the movie can really, you know, bring people back to the book.
Thanks a lot for the call. I got to note that Peggy's comment was going to be on Jurassic Park as a great book to movie. And that was the late Michael Crichton. And I think there's a guy who is writing books with the big screen in mind.
I think that's true. Yeah. And I think that's one. Yeah. And Jurassic Park is, I think that's a great movie. I just saw it. They re-released it in 3D a couple of months ago. And yeah, a great example of a book that's pre-written for the movies, I think.
And speaking of 3D, got about 30 seconds here, Rob, but you're not a big fan of the 3D when it came to The Great Gatsby, huh?
Yeah, when I read it in high school, I didn't think, I need this in 3D. I need Daisy to really pop out of the screen at me here. Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was a mistake.
Getting a little 3D happy these days.
Right, for sure.
Yeah. Well, we are speaking with Rob Thomas, a movie blogger and editor at the Capital Times. And now we'll take a look at the latest state news. And then we'll be back with more of your calls on your favorite or least favorite book-to-film adaptations. Do you look forward to seeing your favorite novel on the big screen, or are you worried that somebody's going to just ruin it for you and take away the beautiful pictures you've got in your head? Well, we'd love to hear. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Be sure to check out the Central Time Facebook page for this and other discussions and just to figure out what the heck we're doing in the future. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Thomas, 77 Square editor at the Capital Times, is here in the studio to talk about book-to-film adaptations that'll be hitting theaters this fall. And we want to know about your favorite adaptation of a book. And what about a least favorite, where they really maybe kind of ruined the experience for you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones now. We've got Barbara, who's with us from Meadowlands, Minnesota. Hi, Barbara.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing just great, thank you. The weather is beautiful. I couldn't ask for anything more.
Excellent. What do you think?
I think that the Stephen King is one of my favorite authors ever. And Carrie, he did a great job. They did a great job with the movie. But The Shining just made me mad. They did such a poor, poor adaptation of it. Such a wonderful book, so scary, and such great characters. And then they put Jack Nicholson in there, and he was like, it was like a totally his thing. And the main thing was the little boy.
Interesting take, because isn't Shining one that goes down in the annals of the greatest horror movies of all time?
Well, yeah, it's...
And that irritates me.
Well, Stephen King did not like Stanley Kubrick's version either. Actually, he went back and got behind a TV miniseries version, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago. So you're in good company there.
Thanks a lot for the call, Barbara. We'll go now to Becky in Madison. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Two of my favorite movies that they did books were Gone with the Wind and Jaws. Ooh. I thought, though, even though they were complicated books, that they did a great job. And the one movie I can't even imagine them making, is called Enders. By Orson Scott Card.
Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, yes.
Yeah, and I heard they had a movie in the pipes a couple years ago, but I never heard what came of it, and I just can't imagine how they can transform that book.
You're kind of breaking up us on there, Becky, but we got the point. Yeah, Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game is in the works. I'm not sure when the release date is.
I saw the trailer last night, as a matter of fact. Yeah, with Harrison Ford and Ben Kingsley, and it looks pretty good, I think. It's coming out November 1st.
Now, I don't know that book. Why is that one going to be so hard to translate?
I don't know. It's about, correct me, Rob, but it's about a kid who's really good at video games.
Sort of. It's a long story. He's a kid who is brought into this, like, Yeah, a Starfighter-type program. At first, it looks like a game, but it turns out to be something bigger, more serious, and more complicated. I don't want to spoil too much there
right.
for people who haven't
gotcha.
Read it.
Gotcha. Okay, that sounds kind of good. Harrison Ford, can't go wrong there.
That's right.
All right, well, thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Candace in Superior. Hi, Candace.
Hello. I am calling about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. That book was, that three-book series was excellent, and I thought they did a good job with the first one, you know, with the Hollywood, the Bond guy. He actually was pretty good. And then, but I have the three set of all three books of the Swedish program that just nailed the book exactly. And that was very interesting to see, you know, the Hollywood version compared to the actual Swedish version that stuck real close to the storyline.
Thanks for the call. What do you think, Rob?
I thought they were both, I saw both the Swedish version and the American version with Daniel Craig. And I thought they were both really good. I thought they both, you know, captured, the, you know, and those are gruesome, gruesome novels, but really captured the sense of it. I got the feeling the American one wasn't a hit, so I'm not sure if they're going to make American books out of the other two in the series or not.
Why do we have to do that anyway? Why do we have to go ahead and remake something when someone else has gone to the trouble of recently doing it and quite well?
Because we don't want to read Veronica. We want it to be in English, so we don't have to read.
English Minglish.
That's right.
We'll get to more calls in just a minute, but I wanted to talk about a couple more movies that are coming out in the fall. 12 Years a Slave, featuring Quvenzhané Wallace, who is in Beasts of the Southern Wild, got an Oscar nomination for that. A really good cast on that. Is that one you're looking forward to, Rob?
Definitely. I think that, if I remember right, is based on a real-life account of an African-American slave, and it's directed by Steve McQueen, not the action hero from the 60s and 70s, but this fantastic British director who did Shame a couple of years ago with Michael Fassbender and also another movie called Hunger. He's really stylish, and I think it's going to be a really interesting movie.
And speaking of Hunger, we have the next installment of the Hunger Games movies coming out, Catching Fire.
Yeah, and the first one was a huge hit, obviously, and I really liked it. I haven't read the Hunger Games either.
Oh, man.
I know, I'm really letting you down, aren't I?
Yeah. I haven't either, I'll admit.
But I would, that's a good example because I would go back and read the other two because I was so hooked by that first movie.
So that's really interesting to me because I thought the book was really compelling. For me, the movie fell flat.
Really, yeah. Well, you know, and that's why they make the movies is because they know there's a large pool of people who haven't read the books and, you know, might get sucked in. So.
Are you just a Jennifer Lawrence fan? Is that what I'm seeing here?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, me too, actually. She's really good.
She's great.
All right, let's take another phone call now. Tom joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Well, hi, how are you guys?
Doing pretty good.
Great topic. I'm going to bring up Michael Crichton. Myself and my children are big Michael Crichton fans, like you've already suggested. But we went to see a movie called, it's from one of his books called Timeline, and it was just horrible. They did just a terrible job converting it into a movie, and it was kind of disappointing. And then, actually, when I was on hold, I thought of something else, too. Is there some movies that actually they have remade from previous movies that were books that are bad, too? Say, like The Hitchhiker's Guide. To the Galaxy was just the American version was horrible, terrible, terrible movie. And then there was a television movie called The Andromeda Strain.
Another Michael Crichton. Yeah.
Right.
Right. And the original movie made in the 60s was really good. The one that they remade was just terrible.
Okay, so not only spoiling a good book, but a good movie, too, with a re-remake.
Right, right. Yeah, I didn't see Timeline, but I heard it was pretty bad. And it reminded me of, like, my favorite Ray Bradbury short story is The Sound of Thunder, which is another sci-fi about time travel. And they made a terrible movie about that about 5 years ago. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems like Hollywood, every few years, they're like, well, maybe they forgot about that movie. Let's make it again, like Andromeda Strain or something like that. So, you know, that's just the nature of Hollywood. They keep rebooting and remaking and reimagining.
Well, Rob, if we're only going to see one adaptation this fall, which one are you rooting for?
Well, 50 Shades of Grey comes out next year, I think. So that's disqualified. I got my eye on that Monuments Man. I just think that's going to be a good, you know, World War II based on a true story. That feels like, you know, this year's Argo in a way for me. But there's a lot of good ones for sure.
Marcia on Facebook writes, here's a movie that trashed the book. Despero. Did I say that right, you guys?
Despero.
Despero. She says, yes, it's a children's novel, but the movie was so bad that the people I took after I raved about the writing fell asleep. I did not see that one. Did either of you?
I think I might have.
Well, you may have slept through it, too.
And I may have slept through
it. Did you go see it with Marcia?
Maybe I did. I think, is that Tale of Despero? Or is it about the mouse?
Because
I think
ears,
I
right?
did see that one.
Yeah.
And I think I thought it was okay. I have to say, I think I have a slightly lower standard for children's movies. If the bar is really high, something like The Secret Garden, which was adapted, I thought was gorgeous and beautifully done. But yeah, Tale of Despero is probably not high up there on my list.
And we had one caller on the line who said Life of Pi. And Rob, you told us beforehand that was one of your favorites.
Yes, I love that movie. And there's a classic example of, like, you take a book and you make it just explode visually on the screen. I mean, I thought it was just fantastic what Ang Lee did. I mean, I think that's – you can't do much better than that in terms of turning a book into a movie.
Yeah.
That's a news I can use. I haven't read the book or seen the movie. I think I may do both.
You should,
based
for
on
sure.
That.
Yeah, both. I agree with that one.
Let's wrap up. I'll share mine. Maltese Falcon, going way back. Love the book, love the movie. It was true to the book, except Sam Spade in the book is a tall blonde guy, and in the movie it's Humphrey Bogart, a short
Wait,
guy with
you're
dark
complaining
hair.
About Humphrey Bogart?
I'm not. I'm saying that's the one, that's the only major difference.
Okay,
otherwise,
good.
And Peter Lorre, you can't go wrong.
All right. Well, Rob Thomas, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was fun.
That's Rob Thomas, editor of 77 Square at the Capital Times, blogger at madisonmovie.org.
And next up, I'll look at the latest news headlines, and then we'll talk about why television journalists are burning out and what that means for the future of the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, Kristen Durst joins us with a few news stories we're watching this afternoon.
Mohamed Morsi is calling it a full coup. That's according to a statement posted on the Twitter account of the Egyptian president's office. The statement was posted shortly after Egypt's military announced it was forcing out Morsi. He was Egypt's first freely elected leader, but he drew anger with his Islamist leanings. Military says it's replaced him with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court. U.S. motorists are getting a break as they head out for the beach and other vacation spots for the 4th of July. Gasoline prices are continuing a summer slide. The average price of a gallon has fallen for 21 straight days and is now below $3.50 for the first time since February. State agriculture officials are warning farmers that heavy rains following a wet spring in southern Wisconsin would lead to overflowing manure storage facilities. Water quality officials also say spreading manure on already saturated fields could lead to manure running off into nearby streams and lakes. Engineers with the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection have been out in the field working with farmers.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
Well, it's safe to say that the media landscape has changed a lot in recent years, and journalists are now expected to do more than ever.
And according to our next guest, the shift is hitting television journalists especially hard and leading to increased burnout for those working in the field. So how might this be affecting your local news station?
Scott Reinerty is with us now. He authored a study looking at TV journalist burnout, and he's an associate professor of journalism at the University of Kansas. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's look at how TV journalism is doing in general. How are stations doing from a business perspective? Are they declining like the newspaper industry?
Actually, much of the previous research demonstrates that there's a growth area in TV, unlike newspapers. They're hiring people. They're expending their airtime. They're expending their efforts online. However, the dimensions of the job have changed dramatically. So it's quite promising for young people coming out of journalism schools or wanting to go into broadcast journalism. There is opportunity out there. However, the jobs are much different than what they were just a few years ago.
And then you went out and surveyed these journalists about that job and how it's changing. What kind of questions were you asking them?
I really looked at some established measurements that examine burnout. The measurement I used was actually established in the early 1980s, and it was developed primarily to look at healthcare workers, nurses specifically. The people that developed it then developed a general survey that looks at burnout from the perspective of any job. So the measurement I used was tested through hundreds of studies, and I was really trying to find out specifically what is affecting that burnout, workload, organizational support, those types of issues, but also the quality of work that the TV journalists are producing and just exactly what their jobs entail.
Well, let's start there with the quality, because even if we're not TV journalists ourselves, this might all be affecting the news we see. How did they feel? Do they feel like they're putting out a quality product in their work?
That certainly has become an issue. I've been studying this issue for about 10 years between newspapers and broadcast journalists, and across the board, quality is definitely the major issue. Journalists feel that they are being pressured to do so many other things, produce content for online or as TV talks, 2 and 3 screens, online and mobile devices, that they're not able to slow it down and take the time that it really takes to do good journalism and quality journalism. So is it more what they would call rice paddy journalism, just scraping the surface, or are we really looking at issues and things that affect the community? And that really becomes the rub. Producing more doesn't necessarily mean you're producing well.
When you watch the TV news, stepping away from the survey, do you feel that? Do you feel that they're maybe sacrificing some quality to try to stretch themselves out?
Yes. I mean, anecdotally, you look at some of the things they're doing. You see a lot more live remote shots. You see a lot more quick-hitting event type of coverage. Everything is screaming breaking news. And what you're really going to run into long-term when you start looking at audience research is a media fatigue factor, where if everything's labeled breaking news or there's so much urgency put to that, then how will the audience really distinguish between what is breaking news and what is immediate and what is not? That becomes a complication for the audience.
So you end up with this urgency inflation. Like, well, that was all urgent, but this next one's super urgent.
Sure, absolutely. It's a social perception of reality. That theory tells us that people who generally watch a lot of TV news perceive the world as being far more dangerous than it actually is. They perceive that all these bad things can happen to you. And as we know, when we live our regular routine lives, the incidence of crime and those types of things on the individual is actually rather small.
Well, taking it behind the scenes on what's going on behind the making of our TV news broadcasts, you had some comments, I think, from people like a person who's actually on the air being expected to tweet multiple times during the broadcast. Did I read that right?
Yes. That was... A person who hosts a morning program, and in between the 3-minute break for commercials, she was basically asked to be tweeting and communicating with the audience, even in a second fashion, which becomes rather complicated when you're trying to prepare for the next segment. So, but you find that journalists are what they call one-man bands. They're being sent out to events. Okay, post something immediately online or send something out on social media. Let us know what's happening. And then write something quick for the online and then put your package together for the television. So it becomes just a constant deadline. It's a perpetual deadline that keeps pushing people harder and harder and harder. And under those constraints, the workload becomes more demanding, and therefore people do suffer things like burnout.
That's a really interesting point, because in the old days, if you were doing the 5 o'clock broadcast or the 10 o'clock, you had a deadline, you had to have your package done by a certain time, and that's what you worked up to. You got the best quality thing you could. Now, if we're going to try to be online all the time, there's, as you said, this constant deadline. How does that affect the quality?
Yeah, that certainly is a concern. And TV, quite honestly, has always been under the premise of trying to develop and build an audience. The audience understands brand. When there's an anchor sitting there, there's a relationship. Well, now the audience has the opportunity to reach directly to that anchor or to that personality and contact and communicate with him or her via Twitter, via blogs, whatever the case may be. So there's actually more of a need and an urgency from the audience to say, oh, I can actually kind of know this person. Instead of this far away reach, they can get a first-person reach to that person. And that does create some additional complications and pressures.
But these stations don't really have a choice, do they? I mean, they have to have this online presence, or do they?
Well, I think they do. I think you need to pick and choose how you're using that resource. I find that in my research that TV has adapted much better to online and social media than newspapers have. All too often, newspaper newsrooms have attached themselves to online. For instance, say, oh, we're going to do online now, or we're going to blog, or we're going to tweet, but they've never given instruction or direction how they want their employees to do that. Television, I think television journalists have a better understanding of audience and how to reach that audience because that's what they've done perpetually throughout their careers.
But as they're doing this, your survey finds they're feeling stretched thin, they're feeling burnout. Is this going to drive some people out of the industry?
Yeah, it certainly shows some indications that could happen. And what some of the much of the burnout was occurring in the 31 to 40-year-old range. So now you're talking younger people with a reasonable amount of experience who may leave the industry because of those pressures, particularly when you add in family pressures and other things that, you know, people want to have lives. And when it's just work, 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 it becomes complicated. Now, the other aspect of that is you get older people are being released from their jobs or they're leaving the industry. Well, there you lose experience and institutional knowledge that young people may not have. So it's really a difficult balancing act for the organizations as well as the journalists who are involved in those organizations.
Well, then how do broadcast stations juggle that and keep doing all the things they want to do in the digital world, keep their quality people around and their experienced people around and not burn them out?
Well, if I had that exact answer, I would bottle it and sell it. But I think, and generally other research has demonstrated that showing value, have your employees have value and understanding the value and really putting forth a directive of where you want to be. Instead of running around doing a whole bunch of things at a mediocre level, really focus in and do some things really well. Because quite honestly, the audience, they're a savvy audience. They will figure it out, and they will see what's good and what's not good. And you will lose audience numbers if you don't continue to produce quality work. So I think putting forth a game plan that values your employees and values the product that you're putting out is certainly the first steps.
Well, is there just a financial imperative here? We're going to do more with less. We're going to keep our labor costs as low as possible by just extending the range of what the journalists are expected to do?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think media managers, particularly through the centuries, have failed to recognize that they have a valued product, and part of that valued product is your valued employee. That's your most predominant resource and your most important resource. And if you're burning those people out and you're not putting out a good product, you will lose customers. So it's, you know, and I know journalists, you know, these diehard journalists, and God knows I'm one of them. Worked 15 years in daily newspapers. They want to be, oh, I want to go out there and do great journalism and you know, tell great stories and shed light into dark areas and those types of things. Those are great things to do, no doubt about it. But in the end, you have to look at, we are a product. How do we get people coming back to us? How do we produce quality information to make an audience want to come back and use our product? And you know, I hate to turn it into commercial terms, but quite honestly, that's the realization. Because if you're not able to do that, people are going to go other places for their news. They'll go other places and use other products, and therefore then you no longer have a job or you no longer have the job you want to have.
In your work, do you see some stations maybe coming to the idea that, yeah, the web and social media is important, but you know what? We're a TV station. We might want to cut some corners on the digital world and commit ourselves to a better quality actual TV broadcast?
I'm sure those entities are out there. I can't speak specifically to any, but that's my next step in the research, to really look to find examples that would show that they're putting out quality, they're not burning their people up, and they're really doing it the right way and are successful financially and also socially and journalistically. That's the next steps in my research, quite honestly.
And in the next step for TV stations, are you optimistic that they're going to keep these people around, maybe lower the burnout rate, and ultimately come up with a better quality product?
I think I have to be optimistic because there is going to be, you're going to come to a tipping point where there's a realization that if we don't take care of this issue, we will lose so many good people in this field. That and then you lose audience, and then where do you go from there exactly? I think there's a way to work the online and the other social media opportunities into what you're already doing to integrate that. And that's really one of the struggles we have as educators. How do we provide our students that type of education to send them out job ready to do the job that needs to be done, but also to balance how to use online, how to use social media, and to best tell the stories that need to be told.
That's a good place to leave it. Scott, thanks so much for being here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Scott Reinerty. He's Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Kansas.
After the news, we'll look at the rape epidemic among migrant workers in the United States. And remember, you can keep track of what's happening by going to our Central Time Facebook page. You'll get sneak previews of what we'll be looking at the next day, and you can look back at some recipes and links to read up more on what's going on.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Stick around. The news is coming up next.